Judge and Judges of the United States Air Force Court for Naval Hills. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court for Naval Hills draw near. The court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
You may be seated. Court is called to order.
Court is called to case of the United States versus the federal employees. Henry Richards, the fourth, case number 38346. You will find him to be under Article 66 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice of both sides ready to present argument.
We are on.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I want to thank you for your flexibility with yesterday's snow schedule, including the bids. And I understand you want to reserve 15 minutes.
Yes.
Are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor. Thank you. Good morning, Court. My name is William Sarah. I think I've met everybody on the board. Along with Captain, should we make it possible? We represent the appellant in this case for 10 Congress Richards. Your Honor, we are focused on two granted issues, and obviously, subject matters of the board on the two other issues. The tracking of the autonomous vehicle that the records we have been on the basis of specification 1 and charge 1 as the good faith exception is applicable to autonomous case and military judge error when we fail to suppress the results of the autonomous search. Secondly, the autonomous denied the effectiveness of counsel when his area of defense counsel disclosed confidential information to the trial counsel that led to the discovery of evidence used against the autonomous trial. And Your Honor, I'll simply go through these methods. I'll listen to my briefing. I'll start with the government placing of a GPS tracking system on the autonomous car liable to the 14th Amendment right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure. There are several important factors in this case, Your Honor. First is, the OSI never requested nor received a warrant. United States versus Jones is clear. The placing of a GPS and monitoring of that GPS constitutes a search and requires a warrant and or authorization. This case is very identical to Jones in that the government placed the GPS on the autonomous vehicle and monitored its movements 24/7 during the time he was under investigation. The only difference between this case and Jones is that in Jones there was a warrant which had expired. In this case, there was never a warrant nor a search authorization. The military judge, while finding that this was a search, denied the defense motion to suppress. The military judge's reasoning is erroneous and must be reversed. And Your Honor, I'm going to take up the three areas that the military judge discussed in chronological order, and obviously subject to any questions by the members of the court.
And let me ask you, what was the evidence obtained by this GPS device?
The fact that the appellant had visited the Tyndall Air Force Base, signed in, they had visitor centers, they were calling on bases, and signed in, paid in and out of the base. And, you know, admittedly, strange hours of the day.
And so it led to the discovery of AP.
That is correct.
And then AP, doesn't the exclusionary rule apply differently to the discovery of witnesses and witnesses' testimony than the test of the
It does, Your Honor. And that's a meaningful case that this court asked us to take a look at. But I think that there's a significant difference between Segalini in this case. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing Mr. Segalini's name correctly, but in Segalini, as the court may recall, the person that the evidence of was the clerk at the store who volitionally provided further information to the police. That's dramatically different from this case where AP was what was back, not the physical evidence and the regular recall that particular term is that were found in Segalini. And so while the court does say that there's a difference when the search shows up evidence of a person as opposed to physical evidence, I don't believe that distinction is that dramatic in this case, owing to the fact that the discovery of the tracking of the GPS router led directly to the discovery of AP, as opposed to the volitional testimony of a witness as it did in Segalini. And the military judge used three bases for determining that the evidence was in fact admissible. First of those was medical discovery. The military judge concluded that the relationship between a pilot and AP could not have escaped the attention of OSI for long.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you go through the three bases that the military judge determined the exclusionary rule did not apply. And I direct you to the third basis, which is the application of Davis. So in Davis, the Supreme Court held that the sole purpose of the exclusionary rule is to deter deliberate or reckless disregard of enforcement of the rule. We therefore would police act in an objectively reasonable, good faith belief that the that their conduct was lawful, exclusionary rule need not apply in that situation. So in this situation, you argue that the police had to, or the OSI had to have some actual knowledge of the state of the law at the time. They had to testify that they relied on some case. Is that correct?
That is part of our argument.
So how far does that go? So do they need to get up there and name a specific case? Do they need to just talk about their general awareness of the laws? How specific do they need to be under your
I would think that a very bare minimum, Your Honor, that the government having the burden at that point has to put on some evidence that says it was our belief, based on our training, based on the instructions that we have received, and based on our knowledge of general principles of law in this jurisdiction, that the placing of a GPS was legal.
I'm sorry, is that the belief of the individual agent, or is that the belief of the agency in terms of OSI and the guidance office of OSI, JA, the legal advisors to the OSI?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, Judge, because in this case, I think one of the things that is being missed is the fact that Jones was obviously working its way through the system at the time that this GPS tracking device was placed on the appellant's car. So OSI does have a jack office, who presumably, in fact, we know that. So we know that they are providing some evidence or some instruction to the OSI agent. So I would think, again, at a bare minimum, the OSI agent who was requesting the applicant, who was actually carrying out the search, would need to be called and say, it's our general understanding, based on the advice that we have received from our JAG, that the placing of a GPS on a vehicle is permissible.
Isn't that essentially, I'm sorry, I could go ahead. Isn't that essentially what happened, though, in terms of the agent saying we followed our procedure?
No, Your Honor, I think that's the big distinction in this case, is that what he said was, like you just said, you know, we asked our higher headquarters and they said it was good to go. What we did not have was any testimony in which they said, it's our understanding when we asked for this, that this is the law in our jurisdiction. That is what we believe. Back to Katzen, which is one of the cases that is cited within Aguilar, states that the binding precedent that they're relying on must be binding precedent from within the jurisdiction that which we sit. And so the OSI agent says, for example, in this case, well, there's so much testimony, I want to make sure I'm getting this right. There was some argument along the lines of, well, that's a binding jurisdiction in the circuit, which is in the Air Force Base. Completely irrelevant. What needs to happen in our view, in Thomas' view, is that OSI agents are required to testify that it is our knowledge and our understanding of the law, based on the instruction that we have received, that the placing of a GPS is permissible. That did not happen in this case.
There have been a number of cases in pretty much every circuit that has applied the Davis position to the now post-Jones paradigm. In any of those cases, is there any indication that in any of those cases where the circuit courts upheld a GPS device's placement on the Davis rationale, has there ever been testimony by the agents that they were relying on anything specific in terms of the state of the law?
I think, and like Ron, I certainly don't have the transcripts of all of those objections brought. If you're asking me if any of those opinions is that reported, I would say the answer is no. But I would also say that you have to look at also Katzen, and which states that it has to be binding precedent within that circuit. Because I think to just say amorphously, it's just binding, you know, it's just our understanding of the law, as opposed to it's our understanding of the law in this circuit, that this is what applies. And I think that's one of the failings in this case, Your Honor.
So put aside the issue about whether or to what extent agents need to testify about their understanding of the law at that point. Why do not the Supreme Court decisions in Knotts and Carroll provide that binding precedent that agents could rely upon to determine if their actions were
Because I think Knotts and Farrell are the Weaver cases are dramatically different. And I think that's why Jones had to be decided. Weaver cases are dramatically different than GPS cases. That's what Jones tells us. So while, yes, the Aguilar court says that reliance upon the two Weaver cases, Farrell and Knotts, is sufficient, the Katzen case cited within Aguilar comes to the exact opposite conclusion. And states that the GPS is a dramatically different tracking device that gets into the proximal, I forget what the exact term is, but it's much more personal tracking of an individual. And that is why the Weaver cases, Knotts and Cairo, this court should not determine that they are determinative on the good faith exception because of the dramatic technological differences between the GPS and the Weaver. That's how the U.S. gets. Your Honor, I would like to touch on the other two issues that the military judge discussed, and one being the inevitable discovery. The military judge concluded that the relationship between AP and the Atomic did not have escaped the attention of OSI for long, but the fact of the matter is it did for months, for 4 months. OSI agents testified, and I think this is also important as it relates to the third exception, that they did not have the manpower to follow the Atomic RAF. There was no contemporaneous physical surveillance. Unlike Jones, there was actual visual surveillance of the appellant. OSI agents stated that they learned that the appellant's business to the visitor center based solely on the information from the GPS. Obviously, if OSI had 24/7 eyes on the appellant, they wouldn't have needed the GPS. The military judge never explained how any of the facts he mentioned led to the conclusion that the identity of AP would have been inevitably discovered. Secondly, the military judge also concluded that even if the search was illegal, it was sufficiently attenuated to make the evidence admissible. Once again, the military judge did not put his reasoning and findings of fact on the record, and therefore supported very little deference from this court. And he does not address the very simple fact that the discovery of all other evidence would not have happened but for the government's conduct. And but for the government's conduct, those times would not have known to do the additional inquiry that the military judge relied upon in making this decision. The road from the illegal activity in this case was straight and short. This case differs from Secretary that there was no eyewitness to the act. There was no meeting, the act being the meeting at the visitor center between AP and the appellant that was discovered by the GPS. Unlike Secretary, the evidence in this case came solely from the GPS and not from a civilian witness. And in Secretary, when the court discussed the difference between discovery of a person and discovery object of an object with the field of the relational comments of the store clerk, and not tracking of an individual by GPS. Subject to any further questions or notes in the court on this particular issue, I'd like to move to assignment number two. Please. Thank you, Judge. The appellant denied that each assistant of counsel and his military defense counsel disclosed confidential information that led directly to the discovery of evidence used to convict the appellant at trial. Quite candidly, members of the court, it is simply impossible to understand why Captain Hawkins would discuss that he disclosed this information to Captain Tussin. The government had no idea who Mr. Kennedy was and had no problem with the search of the appellant's mother's house. When we look at the Strickland standard, it's hard to envision and a counsel falling further below the standard of competent counsel to reveal confidential information to the government. And when we look at the second problem of Strickland, the prejudice standard, the government could not and had not previously decrypted the appellant's computers absent the information that they obtained from the search. When this court
asked us, I'm sorry. Wasn't the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attach?
Absolutely, Judge. I think that is both the McCluskey case and the McKenney case say that McKenney's more directly on point, which was just sort of a casual discussion with a lawyer who was a uniform lawyer. And the courts in both of those cases have said that it was had attached.
Don't we normally hold that the right to counsel attaches a preferral of charges?
In certain ways, it does. But certainly, I think a good analogy of this, just relying on our ways of the world, we've all seen divorce cases where, a spouse will go to see three or four different lawyers, decide to retain the fifth one, the three or four that he or she spoke with employees conflicted off of the case. While the right to counsel may attach a certain legally law is clear in both Kenny and McCluskey. The testimony and the communications between the client and a prospective client and a prospective attorney, and in this case a detailed attorney, are protected, regardless of whether the right to counsel has attached.
Well, I guess, isn't it better framed as an issue other than an IAC at that point? If there's no Sixth Amendment right to counsel at the point where this discussion between defense counsel and trial counsel takes place, how can there be ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, I think that both the client and the attorney, and certainly from the client's perspective, the information that he is giving to Captain Hawkins is privileged information with an attorney.
Why is it retained to privilege when a third party, Mr. Kennedy, is involved?
Because Mr. Kennedy was part of those communications.
Does the appellate staff affidavit indicate that he had a conversation with Mr. Kennedy on the cell phone with Captain Hawkins standing there, where he asked him to come to Florida and to carry out his wishes?
But again, the government had no idea who Mr. Kennedy was. I mean, it's a course question. I think the best way to answer the course question is this. If the government had put a tap on Mr. Kennedy's cell phone and learned this communication, we're not having this discussion. If the government had, through independent research or independent investigation, determined Mr. Kennedy's identity, we're not having this discussion. But the fact that is that the communication between the evidence of the existence of Mr. Kennedy came about solely as a result of Captain Hawkins providing that information to the government.
I'm not sure that answers the question of why is it privileged communication with the defense counsel when there's a third party present?
Well, I'm not sure the proper inquiry needs to be one who is a privilege in terms of, again, Mr. Kennedy had not and disclose that information. Mr. Kennedy calls the police and says, I just learned this, or calls the government. Again, we're not having this discussion. But when the counsel discloses information that he has gotten from his client, that he knows the client does not wish to be public, for example, the communication of that testimony outside of those three people violates the privilege, because the communication was from counsel, not from Mr. Kennedy.
You cited Air Force Rule of Professional Conduct 1.6 for the proposition that Captain Hawkins fell short of his obligations to be the client. What obligation did Captain Hawkins fail to live up to? Is it the duty of confidentiality, or is it the duty of loyalty?
Well, and perhaps it is better drafted on as a question of the duty of loyalty. I mean, while there can be some, I think, discussions we just had on the strict question of whether or not that was privileged outside of those three people. The defense counsel has an absolute right to be completely loyal to his client. And again, the client can envision no further breach or no greater breach of that privilege or that requirement than to disclose that information to the police.
So if it's a duty, it's a matter of the duty of loyalty. Accepting your client's affidavit on face value, there was never any evidence that Mr. Kennedy took out of the house. Your client states that this password document that was found in the appellant's mother's house came from the appellant himself that he drafted at the area defense counsel's office and had mailed to his mother. So there was never anything untoward about Mr. Kennedy being in the house, or never, according to the appellant, anything that Mr. Kennedy did in the house that would cause anybody any concern. So why is it a breach of the duty of loyalty for Captain Hawkins to say that Mr. Kennedy was in the house when under your own client's account, Mr. Kennedy didn't do anything wrong?
Well, I think the first answer to that question, Joe, just because there's absolutely no reason for Captain Hawkins to be having that conversation with the trial counsel.
Isn't there some indication, though, that there was a suspicion by trial counsel that the evidence had been altered in the house, that there was evidence missing, and then that's when says, I gave keys to Mr. Kennedy. And so I'm still trying to figure out, why is the statement, I gave keys to Mr. Kennedy, or Mr. Kennedy entered the house, why is that a privileged communication between your client and Captain Hawkins?
Because obviously, Judge, Captain Hawkins, the appellant, did not envision that testimony. You can see that in his affidavit, and that's where you have a great contradiction between his affidavit and Captain Hawkins. And the appellant did not envision that material going any further, and certainly not going to the trial counsel.
But isn't that different than if your client had said, counsel, But my privileged communication to you is that I earlier asked Mr. Kane to remove things from the house and he has had access to the house. Clearly, communication between the client and the attorney versus Mr. Kennedy's coming here and you give him the keys to get into the house, and then Mr. Hoffman, Captain Hoffman, giving the keys to Mr. Kennedy, and then revealing that he has granted access to the house to Mr. Kennedy, who he has no privilege with, right?
Correct. But again, Ron, I think that we're missing sort of a very fundamental point, which is that the government had no idea who Mr. Kennedy was by their own investigation. And it's certainly not up to a defense counsel, and I think that's even more closely to the Kennedy case that the court has to look at. It is certainly not incumbent upon a defense counsel, I think it's fairly obvious, to be providing the government with any evidence against their client. The very simple thing that should have happened in this case is when the government calls Captain Hawkins and says, "We think somebody's been in this house, what do you know about it?" For Captain Hawkins to say, "I'm not going to answer that question."
Even if Captain Hawkins has no reason to believe that that's likely to lead to any evidence against his client.
Well, whether he knows it, whether he has reason to believe it, well, I don't think it was necessary. I don't think there was any evidence that, in fact, it would be logical to think that Captain Hawkins would not have that conclusion. And if you look at Captain Hawkins' affidavit, which, while we think is somewhat unbelievable on his face, he says, "I thought that this was what we're done. I kept thinking it. You know, but there would be no reason for Captain Hawkins to state as he has in his affidavit that I told the appellant that I was going to provide this information to the government if they asked, because I thought this was really ignorant." Not exactly the terminology, but I think the court gets the point. I mean, Captain Hawkins himself felt that there was a duty to not turn this information over to the government, which is why, in his belief, he got a waiver from the appellant in order to do so. Well, Your Honor, I think the Captain Hawkins affidavit, frankly, is unbelievable on its face and contradicts Captain Miller's testimony at 32. But I will also say that I've been long enough to know that public courts don't always agree with me. And therefore, if the court, I think that the cleanest, for lack of a better term, way to do this is the order to debate and have that debate or report back to the court. I think that will give the court a much better opportunity to see what the underlying facts are and make it. But again, I think the Captain Hawkins affidavit, Frank was unbelievable on his face. And one of the questions the court asked this court to consider is if this court does find an effective assistance of counsel, what is the remedy? And the appellant argued, according to the McCluskey case, it is dismissal of or reversal of the affected specifications. And I think McCluskey does very clearly stand for the proposition that the entire case is not. Just those specifications that are should be reversed. And Your Honor, that concludes my presentation. I look forward to asking to save some time to answer any other questions you have on 404B or on anything else. So I stand ready to do so.
I would like to talk about issue 1D, the scope of the OSI's search. So as I understand it, essentially the defense position here is that OSI exceeded the scope of the search and realized there's a separate issue about the breadth of the search authorization. But essentially, as I understand your position, is that whatever communications means, OSI still had no business looking through the pictures for it because there was no evidence that there were any pictures that were supportive of this state law that the appellant's question was. Would you agree with me that a picture can be a form of communication? In other words, a person could violate the state law by sending pictures back and forth with a minor?
Yes. I think that one, yes.
Okay. So it's just a matter of if there wasn't sufficient evidence in this case?
That's correct. I'm sorry.
We knew that they were Skyping, right? And that is in the record of the trial.
Yes.
Can we rely on our own common sense and knowledge of the ways of the world and understanding that it's not uncommon for people who text back and forth, you chat back and forth, you Skype back and forth, if there are any pictures involved?
You don't know, Robert and my daughter in Hawaii for a year, we Skype each other back and forth consistently, and we call it the same work, pictures through Skype. And part
Yeah, I think that is the question. I mean, is it reasonable for OSI to think that there might be pictures involved, given the type of communications that are going back and forth?
I don't believe it is. And there's certainly no evidence in that record. I think what the evidence shows in this case is that what this really was with a fishing expedition for child pornography among the other little brothers that the government did not have probable cause to search for. And I think that's why they asked when they sent the request to DCFL. They didn't say search for communications. They said search for videos and photos, or you know videos and photographs and possible online communications. Because I think that's what this was a fishing expedition, plain and simple. So I do not believe that is a reasonable conclusion based on the evidence in this case.
To follow up on their request, online communications evidence, isn't that in this day and age, implied photos?
There's certainly.
And even videos?
There's certainly no evidence in the record that supports that judge. I think the simple answer to the question, Judge, is this. If they have looked at the online communications, and within those online communications, they see photographs that are suspicious of child pornography. That's one.
Let me ask you, what is the defining of online communications? I think that's what we're asking you. Doesn't online communications by itself include pictures and videos? I mean, certainly this court has issued numerous opinions where online communications between adults and minors have included sexually explicit material set back and forth. So why, given that background that this court has in other cases of the prevalence of communications including both pictures and videos, why doesn't communications in this case include pictures and videos?
Well, if it did, Your Honor, there's two reasons why it doesn't. One, if it did, the government would not have needed to say videos, images, and possible online communication. The OSI themselves drew that distinction. And secondly, if there was, there would have been no need for the second search authorization in this case. The OSI would have just said, everything's covered by communications, so it would not need to do a subsequent search authorization for possible child pornography. So I think that question is relying on the government's own evidence in this case.
He cited our decision in the United States versus Osorio for support for the proposition. In that case, we relied on the 10th Circuit case of U.S. v. Carey. Would you agree with me that the 10th Circuit has gone to great lengths since Carey to limit the holding in that case? And they've issued a number of decisions since then, citing Carey, but noting that agents are to be granted reasonable latitude in determining the parameters of a search when it comes to computers.
The honest answer to that question, Judge, I don't know. I haven't looked at Carey and his progeny since then, but I will certainly take the court's word for it. But I don't have a definitive answer. So if you have any further questions from the House of the Court, this concludes my presentation. Thank you, Mr. Court.
Thank you.
Chief Judge Mitchell, may it please the court, Captain Thomas Elk, along with Lieutenant Colonel John Nolan, we represent the United States in this case. The OSI agents in this case acted in good faith by following the binding Supreme Court precedent, which previously held that the warrantless use of a tracking device to monitor the movements of a car on public roads did not violate the Fourth Amendment. Moreover, the military judge properly found that the witness discovered as a result of the GPS monitoring, AV, was still been discovered by the investigating agents, who were already closely monitoring and investigating the appellant due to an allegation of child sexual abuse. Further, any possible taint from an alleged unconstitutional search in this case would have dissipated by the time OSI spoke to that witness and executed a search authorization on the appellant's home. Additionally, and equally important, the appellant received effective assistance of counsel at all stages of this case. Captain C.H. never violated the attorney-client privilege, nor did he expose any confidential communication to the trial counsel in this case. Now, first, with respect to the GPS device, I'd like to take the issues a little bit out of order from our brief, and I'd first like to address the Supreme Court's case in the United States against Davis. Now, the authorization that was obtained through the OSI channel on 16 August of 2011, that's located at 27 to 37 at page 19 and 20. Looking at that, we can see that the agents were acting in good faith in requesting that authorization and then putting the GPS device on Ellen's car. When they conducted that activity, they were not acting deliberately, recklessly, or with gross negligence, nor was there any kind of recurring or systemic type of misconduct by the police in this case, which Davis talks about as well. Their behavior was in good faith. And unless the exclusionary rule is to become a strict liability regime, then it has absolutely no application in this particular case.
So now, what legal authority provided their good faith belief that their actions were lawful? Is it the Supreme Court decisions? Is it this Northern District of Florida case? Is it just generally the state of law? What is it?
Your Honor, at the very least, it was not some hero. And if you look at U.S. v. Aguilar, which this court pointed out, in U.S. v. Katzen, which the appellant talks about, U.S. v. Katzen, and I provide the cite in our brief, was an en banc opinion that reversed the three-judge panel that was referred to in Aguilar. And in that case, the Third Circuit and the Second Circuit were dealing with the situation that you're dealing with here today, Your Honor. And that's that Captain hasn't provided us any kind of guidance in this area, and this court hasn't provided any guidance in this area. So just like Aguilar and just like Hansen, there was no guidance outside of the Supreme Court. See, the United States would say that, yes, the Supreme Court case law at the time was what was binding precedent. Aguilar found that in Hansen, which was an en banc opinion, also found that even though there was no circuit case law.
So it sounds like you're backing off the position in your brief. In your brief, you really took the position that the Horton case in the Northern District of Florida provided the primary support for the Lord's side. Is that no longer the government's position?
It's just more of an argument, Your Honor, that had the agents wanted to go to a federal magistrate to get a warrant, they would have to go to the Northern District of Florida. And in the 11th Circuit case that we provided to this court reads for, in our subset, we list the 11th Circuit opinion, and that refers back to a case of Michael, which was a Fifth Circuit decision, when the 11th Circuit was part of it. So, even in that circuit, the law at the time was that it was permissible. So,
a district court decision binding in the circuit or in the district?
Well, Michael was, which was the binding decision in the 11th Circuit at the time. So,
regardless, Davis required binding appellate precedent for investigators to rely upon in order to advance decision to apply, correct?
I think that appellant is correct, that the Northern District of Florida is not binding on the West side in the sense that a half decision would be. So in that sense, I guess it wouldn't be binding, but it's an additional persuasive authority that even in the location where they were landing. We also cite, if I could cite, the Long Spring site here, the U.S. v. Sparks First Circuit decision, U.S. v. Andres, 5th Circuit decision, I think by the court, these citations, U.S. v. Brown, 7th Circuit, U.S. v. Pineda Moreno, which is the 9th Circuit, U.S. Every single one of these has applied to Davis' test and said that prior to Jones, the understanding was that a trespass was not what triggered the search. So, I guess, I'm not trying to be around the way of answering your question, the binding case law was the Supreme Court. They were the case for the agency. And also in light of, because we Knox, the big holding that came out of that, that the agents could have objectively reasonably relied on this, if I can quote that case. A person traveling in an automobile on public thoroughfares has no reasonable expectation of privacy in his movements from one place to another. And that's, of course, referring back to the CAS test of reasonable expectation of privacy, which was always, up until Jones, that was the test. It had nothing to do with the physical trespass. So then U.S. v. Caro even goes a step further. In that case, they say the existence of a physical trespass is only marginally relevant to the question of whether the Fourth Amendment has been violated. And I'd like to highlight this part. For an actual trespass is neither necessary nor sufficient to establish a constitutional violation. So Caro goes a step further and says that a trespass, when the agents are looking at the case law, they're being informed by OSIJ, in which they were, because they took Beaver off as soon as Jones came down. When they're looking at this, they have two cases that say that, number one, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy on public thoroughfare. Number two, a trespass is not what triggers a Fourth Amendment search. And then even a step further, the Supreme Court in Jones talks about the trespass doctrine. not being inconsistent with previous cases. And with respect to Justice Scalia, he tries to distinguish Oliver versus the United States, which was the big case on the open fields doctrine. And he says, in that case, there was a physical trespass onto the person's property, but he says that even though there was a trespass, that's still not a search in the constitutional sense. So even Justice Scalia is recognizing that the physical trespass in certain circumstances, even under the Jones regime, doesn't necessarily trigger the Fourth Amendment analysis. So in view of all those things, and also in view of Burton, and in view of the 11th Circuit's take on inserting a beeper on somebody's property, the agents were objectively relying on binding Supreme Court precedent. It Aguilar actually, I believe it was Aguilar, that says that even if it's not binding, this court can still adopt the general good faith test, or the general test that was in Harriman that's come out of the line of cases where they say that the exclusionary rule is not automatic.
Are you still arguing that there wasn't the Fourth Amendment violation here, that this case is somehow different from Jones because of the contemporaneous monitoring that was going on there?
I think that this court can decide the case without having to decide that question. It's a difficult question because the Supreme Court hasn't provided any guidance. But the government's position is that it's important to look at Jones not for just what it says, but what it doesn't say. All Jones says is that there was a search. Jones specifically says, in any article in references, did not address the issue of whether the warrantless use of a GPS device would be, quote, reasonable and thus lawful under the Fourth Amendment, where officers have reasonable suspicion and any probable cause to execute the search.
But Jones was all about the physical trespass that took place in that case. It had nothing to do with reasonable expectation of privacy, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Was there a physical trespass in this case?
There was, Your Honor, yes. So, but that's what triggers a search. Now, whether or not that search was reasonable, the Supreme Court did not address. And in light of Military Rule of Evidence 315G3, which discusses the automobile exception, which adopts the automobile exception, the Supreme Court didn't address the automobile exception or exigencies or anything like that. So the United States still think they give up the ghost as far as, was this a reasonable search? Our position that it was still reasonable because they had reasonable suspicion. And that's evidence by the fact that they actually had to articulate what exactly is causing them to go up to their higher authority and get permission to do this. And this physical intrusion is no more intrusive than a Terry stop. In fact, it's a lot less intrusive than a Terry stop, but a Terry stop requires a reasonable articulable suspicion. And so we would say that that would still get you over the threshold of the Fourth Amendment requirements.
Let's talk inevitable discovery for a minute. For 6 months, OSI, in your own words, devoted significant resources to this case, and they were committed to learning if the appellant was engaged in any inappropriate conduct with other young males. During this entire time, the appellant would bring AP onto base, to his base home, signing him onto base, apparently at odd hours of the evening and the morning. And despite the, whatever physical surveillance was going on, despite that physical surveillance, not once did OSI think to check out the visitor center records. Appellant lives on base. If he's bringing young males in, he might be signing on the base. We better check that. It's only after the GPS data went in that they thought to do that. It's the government's burden to demonstrate inevitable discovery. How, under these facts, has the government proven by preponderance of the evidence that these visitor center records would have been found?
Yes, Your Honor. So I'd like to first start the question out with the lens with which you look at this issue, and that's with the abuse of discretion standard. Now, that's a standard that the government doesn't always like in Article 62 appeals, but in Article 66, it's the same standard. And that's that you look at the findings of fact of the military judge in a light most favorable to the prevailing party. Appellant is not able to point to any specific facts that are clearly erroneous. The military judge applied the correct law, and he came out with the conclusions, and we would just argue that under that very deferential standard of review, you should be giving great deference to the judge's findings of fact. But to your specific question, I don't think we should be too hard on the OSI agents, because if you look at the ROIs, which is located in actually in the defense zone motion of Appellant Exhibit 37 on page 65, starting on page 65, it lists all of the things that OSI was doing contemporaneous with physical surveillance and everything. If this court would allow me, I'd like to go through just a few of those things quickly here. So they talked to the Big Brothers and Big Sisters program directors. They talked to JP on the 4th of May of 2011. They talked to a bunch of other little brothers as well. They had several interviews lined up talking to other little brothers. They talked to DP's family. They talked to her daughter, to the son. They checked youth centers around Sentinel Air Force Base. So they went to a number of different organizations trying to find out the safety of all the children that were around that area. They went there to make sure that he was having no contact with those individuals. That's on page 123 of that same color exhibit. They did the trash pull in July of 2011. And then the agents both testified that they conducted around-the-clock surveillance. And yes, there's no testimony on the record that says we surveilled him physically and saw him actually go onto base. They were still conducting physical surveillance. What's important is they saw him leaving a high school football game with AP eventually. And then, as this court knows, they eventually actually found him in a vehicle with AP after they had gotten rid of the GPS trail. So it's not a question of inevitable discovery, it's discovery. They actually were led to AP. And so, in hindsight, was it a silly oversight? Of course it was, but I think this kind of dovetails too with the attenuation of Taney. And that's that OSI with the GPS tracker was drawn to the visitor center, but they had to take additional steps in addition to that to find this witness. They had to pull the logs, they had to call the witness up. So the government would argue that the military judge's findings, in fact, are clearly supported by the record. They're not arbitrary, fanciful, or anything like that. So even if you didn't apply that deferential standard, the military judge's ruling should be upheld by this court. And if I can just take a quick step back to the previous discussion, I know that the appellant referenced USB SDI, Future Health, Ninth Circuit opinion that has to deal with actual knowledge of the OSI agents. And I just wanted to touch on this. That particular case stands for the proposition that if you have a broad warrant and there's an affidavit attached, that the agents have to basically be constrained to the terms of the affidavit. Now that's limited very specifically to good faith exception as it relates to warrants in the Ninth Circuit. It has nothing to do with the good faith exception as applied to U.S. v. Davis and Supreme Court's application of the exclusionary rule. So I just wanted to make sure that this court can easily distinguish those two concepts and help the compelling to find any refuge in that case. And I also wanted to touch on the idea of the notion that the MCM somehow provides an automatic exclusionary rule that the president has suffered to make sure that, you know, unlike the Supreme Court, when the Supreme Court has said the exclusionary rule should be very limited, the president grants more protections and service members, but at least two, in the Azaria case at Taft, at least two of the judges at Taft, including Judge Irving and Judge Baker, have said that the president, their opinion is that the exclusionary rule is the same, it's concurrent with what the Supreme Court has found to be the exclusionary rule. So the MCM does not provide an appellant any more protections. And I'd also point this court to MRE 311C1, MRE 314K, 315A4, every one of those provisions in each one of the military rules of evidence having to deal with searches and seizures essentially provides a sliding scale for when the U.S. Constitution changes and the protections change, then the protection of the MCM will correspond to the change.
That's all we turn briefly to the order of the challenge. And that is foreign choice and foreign preference. And that has the same challenge here. Same question.
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. And, you know, this sort of thing, these sorts of tactical decisions happen all the time. First off, this is an issue that particular issue has not been raised. I mean, I know it was mentioned, but it wasn't specifically raised that the forum choice should somehow be undermined because of a ruling on a motion. But I'll just point this court to the record that there were dozens of motions filed. And this court can't go back and say, okay, it was because of this one or this one that they elected to select.
Defense counsel did specifically state on the record it was two forwards by the military judge that led to the choice to go to judge alone. In that situation, let's say it was just one, we all the facts slightly. This issue drove the foreign choice. Is that a form of friendliness? And now his options, he now in his own mind no longer able to go before members because of the prejudicial nature of this evidence.
That, and again, the specific issue hasn't been granted, so I don't want to get too far into the weeds as far as what the case law says, because there could be, I think there is case law because it talks about this form of trust being prejudice. But I would argue no. I mean, these are decisions that have to be made, and it's not as if it's a, when you put on the record, you're going to make a peremptory challenge because of an adverse ruling to a judge, and the court will look at that. I don't believe the case law says that that's the same application that would be applied in the case when you make a form selection. Because it would just be very hard to put the genie back at the bottom. At that point, it would be almost, if there was error, then it's almost per se prejudicial under that argument. Because it's like, well, we would have chosen the judge, and therefore we the whole verdict is not an argument.
Well, continuing on this issue, issue five, which we did specify as a good question about today. 4.4b allows evidence of other acts for purposes other than to show actually conformity with that other act. It lists certain other purposes that are allowable. Which purpose or purposes specifically does the government believe that this evidence, this testimony by the appellant's ex-wife, could show?
So,
motive, opportunity, intent, what is it?
So, it would be the three things that the military judge put in his findings. And again, not to beat a dead horse, but again, under the 404B issue, again, the standard is very deferential, and one that's an abuse of discretion standard. It's a non-constitutional type issue, so even if you do find any kind of error, the prejudice is going to be harmless beyond reasonable doubt. But with that in mind, it would be the three things that the judge said. It would be motive, it would be intent, and it would be
important. Let's take them one by one. How does it show motive? What motive does it show that's relevant in this case?
I think motive and intent are very similar in this case. And the motive is that the fact that he was sexually stimulated by a child, the fact that he was disappointed when the child left but not his wife left. This court can, we can talk all day about whether or not what the weight of that testimony is, but the threshold of whether it's admissible is the Reynolds test, and those make the fact more likely that he would be attracted to other children. That's not propensity evidence saying he did something he's more likely to do it now. That's that he has a sexual desire with children, and he did. And
that's
not
like a 414 argument. The government didn't move to admit this, or didn't oppose the motion limiting on a 414 basis. I assume you're not arguing that 414 is applicable to this prior, are you?
I think that was probably done because thinking in 414 it actually has to be an active child molestation. So that would be why. I think the argument can still be the same, though, is that if he's sexually stimulated by children and he's upset that the child being, he set up the situation where he's gotten close and married to a woman who he's never consummated a relationship with, so that the logical relevance is that so that he can be close to a child. Just like he was involved with his brothers and his sisters, so he can get close to those child. And that goes to the plan as well. That this is a similar type of plan that he has, where he will be close to children, treat the best of children. And I think this case is distinguishable from both Morrison and Barnett. Where in those cases, the facts were completely different. In fact, I think it was in Morrison where the facts of the 404B evidence were far more severe. And that was how Taft had the problem, that you're admitting this evidence is far more severe than what you actually charged. You don't have that here. This isn't severe. In fact, if you took this evidence away, there would be no prejudice. The other evidence that came out was certainly damaging enough in the government's position. Also in Barnett's distinguishable because the military judge never conducted a 403 penalty test. The military judge did all of those things. He found that these were logically relevant. So that would be my answer to your question, Your Honor.
Counsel, let me ask you one more 414. No, they're not proper to catch file under 414. I don't judge under 414. This court, at this stage, found the evidence in this
illicit conduct contacting, with, I think it would be an Article 134 offense, given the timing, in terms of indecent acts of the child that is supported by another who intentionally touched the genitalia for the purpose of arousing or gratifying the sexual desire of himself or another person. And isn't that what his exploit describes? And so, even though not law for that trial from this court,
I know there's some notice requirements, so there may be an issue about that, Your Honor, but outside of the notice requirements, and I know that Appellant brought that up a little bit in his brief with regard to Form 4D, but that would just give them more time to respond to the issue. But I don't see any reason why this court could not find retroactively that it was admissible under both Form 4D and Form 4D. So there would be no, I guess it would go more to a prejudice analysis as well, possibly.
I understand your argument about the standard of review. But was intent or motive, if you want to call it that, at all an issue here? And the government had photographs that showed the opponent engaging in explicit conduct with the child. Was there any doubt that if the government demonstrated that the opponent was the person in the photo was committing these acts, that this was done with the necessary intent to gratify sexual desire? How is this intent at all relevant to this case?
Well, under Article 134, the way these indecent acts were charged, one of the elements was that he was doing it to gratify his sexual desires. And I think the appellant says somewhere in the brief or in his reply that that's usually, without that, then you can then stop as relevant. Well, we have that. The government had proved that. So the photographs were still shots. They didn't show any of the circumstances surrounding what was going on at the time back then or even testified. So the government, yes, could the government prove that charge without this evidence? Maybe. But this evidence certainly lent credence to the idea that he was putting his genitals on a child while he was sleeping and playing with and manipulating the child's own genitals while he was sleeping for his own sexual desires. We know that because he's attracted to other children. So I think that logical that's why the government, in fact, that's why Colonel Christensen brought the evidence during the trial.
So,
well, under the standard of a non-constitutional error, Your Honor, I would think not, Your Honor, no, because it's not under harmless beyond a reasonable doubt test or maybe an argument because it's we don't know which one, you know, what saved the day here, but as Judge Weber pointed out, there certainly was a lot of evidence that indicated it. I know that's both ways, but there was evidence that indicated it. But the government, at the time, you never know what evidence is going to be needed to convince the fact finder. So, in hindsight, we can't say, well, they didn't really need this, I don't think. If I could touch back on inevitable discovery, I'd like to point this court specifically.
Refocus you rather than think we've done rather than discovery. Let's talk about the search warrant and the search of the electronic media. And that is what part of this warrant authorizes the search of photos, videos, as opposed to as the subject of text based communications.
So if you look at the authority to search and seize, I believe it's attached to. Well, there's a 37 or 38 on page 162. It says that they can seize all electronic media and power cords or devices capable of transmitting or storing online communications. Now, they found a picture that had a chat in it, essentially. So the idea that pictures cannot hold chats not only doesn't hold water, it doesn't hold water in this case because they actually found precisely what they were looking for. So
we can't use that, can we? I mean, we can't use what they ultimately find to determine what was reasonable at the time of the search.
No, Your Honor, but I think it shows that it ratifies the principle that photos and video can contain communications, and they often do. So to limit it, and this court did point out with the appellant that if you look at Carey in the 10th Circuit, since then, they have repudiated almost that entirely what Rosario was based on in Casey. they've repudiated that and said, as they said to whoever, that they have an enormous amount of leeway. So in looking for communications, yes, they're allowed to go through photographs and videos, because that's where communications could be, and that's where communications were, in fact, they were present in this case.
So does that allow OSI to look through every picture on every hard drive in the appellant's residence? The fact that they suspected he was communicating, that he was engaged in communication over gaming systems and through MSN and through Skype, how far does that extend? I mean, we're talking about what's reasonable under this scenario, right? The touchstone of the Fourth Amendment. What's reasonable in this situation? Is it reasonable for them to go through every one of his photos?
Once you have a search authorization that allows you to look for online communications, including communications involving Skype, then I think in order to do a proper search, you would have to look at photographs and videos to make sure that you're finding all of the evidence. I mean, that's the entire point of the search authorization, and that's not constitutionally overbroad.
Can they go through one of his Word documents? Can they go through one of his spreadsheets? Can they go through one of his PDF documents? Is there any part of the hard drive that they cannot look at under this scenario?
Well, I think that if you look at just the plain meaning of the search authorization, any online communications, that's going to be limited to online communications. So documents, Word documents, may not contain that. But videos and pictures certainly can contain screen captures, which is what, in this case, what they found. Screen captures of Skype conversations or videos of, oftentimes you'll see videos of an appellant masturbating over while they're chatting at the same time with somebody. So I would say it would be limited to things that are reasonably within the scope of the warrant. But outside of that, I mean, it's hard to do it on the case, but it's hard to do it now looking at hypotheticals. But I think that in this particular case, the search was reasonable.
Help me understand what the agent did. How far did his search extend before he found evidence of child pornography and stopped? He sent this off to DCFL to get a forensic data extraction. What was he requesting from DCFL? Was he requesting an entire copy of all these hard drives, or was he requesting that DCFL do some sort of cut at that level to provide OSI back with relevant evidence?
The request to DCFL, the initial request, said it essentially enlisted the terms of the search authorization and said pictures, video, and any other essentially evidence of an online communication. And then DCFL did that forensic copy, sent it back, and as the agent was going through basically thumbnails, that agent stopped, which is exactly what Casey was. The agent stopped when he got his official search authorization.
Did DCFL copy everything up from these hard drives, or did they make some sort of judgment at that point as to what was relevant to OSI's request?
They did a forensic digital extraction, and the record isn't exactly clear as to what the scope of it was, but my interpretation of that was they have a particular type of software that assists in going through that visual extraction. And the agent started to go through it and then found himself upon the child pornography. And the agent did exactly what you would want the agent to do, and that is to stop and then go to an independent neutral magistrate and get an additional search authorization for the child pornography.
I guess part of my struggle here is, why did DCFL provide an FDP with 10,000 images of child pornography if OSI's request to DCFL says we want pictures, images, and other communications relevant to the matter being investigated? They weren't investigating child pornography, correct?
That's right.
So why did DCFL provide all this to them?
Well, there's no testimony that DCFL was highlighting anything in there or saying, hey, we found child pornography or anything to that extent. They just kind of did a garbage in, garbage out, they made a copy and sent it back with the software to be able to.
So DCFL is not exercising any judgment at that stage. It's the government's understanding of the record.
That's my understanding, Your Honor. That's correct. Yes.
And then how how much did the agent have to sort through the pictures folder before he came across the record seems a little bit unclear to me from that point. At one point it says, you know, maybe it was my fourth or fifth subfolder that I came across these. At one point it indicates that he's gone through the entire allocated space of the FDP and then he has to go into the unallocated space before he finds these. What's your understanding?
My understanding would be the same understanding, Your Honor, and that's, I believe that's, I don't know the exact number, but that's my interpretation of it. So, as the agent is going through, pursuant to the warrant, looking for online communication and things like that, if they stumble upon CP, I don't even think they're necessarily required to go get a search authorization because it's in plain view. But this agent took that a step further. And as this court mentioned, you pointed out, Judge Weber, that Casey has been somewhat repudiated by the 10th Circuit. If you shepherdize that case, the later case that I'm going to be referring to, that's 439F3D1263, and I can provide that as a subsite. But they say that a computer search may be as extensive as reasonably required to locate the items described in the warrant based on probable cause.
And that's the question, David. I'm sorry, I know I'm monopolizing your time, but the post carry cases still do, and the cases from the other circuits still do require the agent to have some sort of a reasonable search methodology to prevent this from turning into a general search, because the Fourth Amendment prohibits. What was a reasonable search methodology under this situation? Was it reasonable for the agent to look through the entire pictures folder when at least the thrust of the evidence in this case indicated that it was more text-based communication?
It's difficult for me to speculate with the record that we have, Your Honor, but the record that we do have indicates that in this case it was reasonable, which is obviously the important case that grounded with the cert. So in future cases or in different cases, that might be different. If the search authorization says something else, or if the agent is starting to go into a different folder, these things are, the case law is always developing, but to quote that same case, the 10th Circuit said, while officers must be clear as to what it is they are seeking on the computer and the conduct of the search, conduct the search in a way that avoids searching files and facts not identified in the warrant. Again, computer search may be as extensive as reasonably required. So they do have leeway. Now, other cases may be different, but in this case, the officer did everything properly because I don't need to belabor the point that an officer went additional search authorization. And the magistrate, it's important to keep in mind that the magistrate at that point could have said, you know what, I don't think there's sufficient probable cause here. And that would have been the end of the matter, but that's not what happened. They granted the additional search authorization.
So you brought up the clarity of the warrant. Let's talk about that authority to search and seize dated, what is it, 11?
10 November.
Thank you. 10 November, which says, I authorize a search of a person seizure of the following specified property, all electronic media and power cords for devices capable of transmitting or storing online communications. Does seizure point to search?
Well, Your Honor, that specific issue I don't think was in the presented issue, so just in the issues that were going to be presented to the court today, but I think off the top of my head, I think that all of the this is a standard document. If that calls into question every single search, then this is going to jeopardize many, many cases down the road because the search authorization, the implication is that once you seize the property, once the police have lawfully seized it, then they're in the ability to search it if there's any reasonable expectation of privacy, is secured by the fact that the warrant was obtained. So I'd like to touch on the ineffective assistance of counsel issue. And as appellants highlighted, that only refers to charge one, spec one. And that was, charge one, spec one was supported entirely by prosecution exhibit 38, which was 11 images, and trial counsel stated that affirmatively on the record at page 469. Again, I'd like to remind the court of the standard of review. Typically, IAC claims are reviewed by this court de novo, But in this case, the government is alleging that Cohen forfeited this issue because he didn't bring it up during the trial. When Captain C.H. stopped representation and separated from the Air Force, Appellant was appointed two very competent attorneys who could have very well brought this issue up and brought the fact-finding issue up to the military judge, but they did not do that. So the government would say, as a starting point, the standard of review should be more difficult for Appellant. Not only that, but it also goes to whether or not you can trust this Appellant and whether his credibility is at issue. Now, I know you asked a question about whether the Sixth Amendment attaches, and that's not absolutely clear, but it would indicate that previous case law has said that referral is the triggering device. But in this case, the alleged disclosure happened on 18 May of 2012, whereas referral occurred on 28 June of 2012. But even assuming that the Sixth Amendment attaches, you have to look at the Polk standard, of course, and you have to look at first whether the allegations are true. And if so, is there a reasonable explanation for counsel's actions? If they're true, did the level of advocacy fall measurably below the performance ordinarily expected of fallible lawyers? And then the last step in the analysis, of course, is whether there's a reasonable kind of prejudice, whether there's a reasonable probability that this would have any outcome on the effect on the outcome. So the first question, the first point I'd like to make is, number one, these communications were not privileged. If you look at Appellant's declaration, which is dated 3 December of 2014, he says, quote, Captain C.H. allowed me to use his work cell phone to call Mr. Kennedy while meeting with Captain C.H. in the confinement facility. During that phone conversation, I asked Mr. Kennedy, if he could come down to Florida and transport my dog to my mother's home in New Jersey. He goes on to say several days later, Mr. Kennedy flew down to Florida and met with Captain C.H. At this time, Captain C.H. provided my house keys to Mr. Kennedy. And then this is a very important point. That same day, Mr. Kennedy came to the confinement facility and met with me. During this meeting, I kept a list of items that I wanted him to take to my mother. Some of the items were for the care of my dog, other items were for my mother, et cetera, et cetera. So Appellant is trying to assert essentially an attorney-client privilege over a communication he had independently with Mr. Kennedy. Now turning to Captain MT's declaration, the trial counsel in this case, he says very clearly, Captain C.H. informed me that Mr. Paul Kennedy had been at Appellant's house. Not knowing who that was, I asked about Mr. Paul Kennedy, Captain C.H. provided me his phone number. There's nothing in any of these declarations that this court has to resolve in a due date hearing that indicates that he relayed any communication. Further, any privilege communication. Now, in candor to this communal, the privilege rules, Appellant did point out that the privilege rules are different than the model rules as well as the Air Force rules. So, the model rules being, and the Air Force 1.6, although it seems that Appellant has abandoned that effect, but even Rule 1.6 expands the protection of the attorney-client privilege and says information related to the representation. Well, there's nothing that indicates that, according to Appellant, who said I wasn't engaging in anything illegal or trying to hide evidence or anything like that, there's nothing to indicate to his ADC at the time that this would be anything related to the representation. In fact, if you're to believe Appellant's argument, then this was just him trying to get his dog and his car moved. So it had nothing to do with the pretrial confinement hearing or charges or anything like that. So the notion that this is somehow privileged is simply incorrect. I'd also like to point out,
if we go on to that, didn't Captain Buckley have seemed to think it was privileged, so to be plain police and got a waiver and he could disclose this? What do we make of his perception of what he was experiencing?
I think he was doing exactly what he should do with a lawyer because he had no evidence that there was any kind of misconduct. So he went to his clients and he said, even though he had gut feeling, he said, I understand that this is just a routine thing, but know that this is an act of privacy, and I'm gonna have to let the government counsel know if something is moving. So that's exactly what you'd expect an attorney to do. Especially if your client is saying, oh no, this is just so there's nothing indicating that Appellant wanted any of this confidential or this somehow related to the representation. Appellant can't have it both ways. He can't say that this was somehow related to the representation because I was trying to move evidence, and then at the same time say, well, no, I wasn't doing anything like that. So I'd also like to point to Air Force Rule 1.6B3 of our rules. It says even if confidential disclosure is necessary, you can disclose the potential of a criminal charge against the lawyer based upon a motive in which the client was involved. That's another thing I want this court just to consider, that there were allegations that there was some kind of criminal misconduct possibly going on involving the lawyer, and the lawyer responded very minimally. If you look at exactly what he provided, he said, all he was there, and here's his phone number, and that's all he provided. And also,
when this issue was first raised, it was based on essentially a bare bones assertion. There was a notation of some cryptic note in the OSI report of investigation, but there was no affidavit from the opponent to support it. And we had almost no facts to go on. Now we have a big mess of facts. We have three affidavits that are all totally at odds with each other. We have some indications, some facts in the appellant's own affidavit, which perhaps cut against his position. We have some facts in Captain Hawkins' affidavit, which perhaps indicate, you know, a lean toward INC. I don't believe we're in a better position now than when we were at first, when we first said we didn't need affidavits on this issue. Now that we have affidavits that are so at odds with each other on such fundamental points about what occurred here, why isn't the prudent thing just to send this back for debate?
Because, Your Honor, I think you said, even assuming what Alan is saying is true, there still was no confidential communication. There still was nothing protected by Rule 1.16. There was no violation of loyalty. Also, looking at Air Force Rule 3.4, it says a lawyer shall not unlawfully obstruct another party's access to evidence or unlawfully alter, destroy, or conceal a document or other material having potential evidentiary value. That's also discussed. The province case that this court cited. So, even assuming all that, even assuming the elect most favorable to appellant, which is not standard, but even assuming that, there's still no fact finding that needs to be done in this, of what I've just said. But if this court still wants to look at whether or not there was an actual waiver, then we would indicate that you should look at the gain factors, and specifically number one and four. And just very quickly, number one says if the facts alleged in the application alleged herein, would not result in relief, even if any factual dispute were solved in the appellant's favor. The fourth one is if the affidavit is factually adequate on its face, but the appellant filing the record as a whole compellingly demonstrates the probability of that. The important thing here is that this also goes to remedy as well, whether or not, even if you find that, even if you find that the counsel should have done this, no prejudice, and he would not be entitled to any relief because simply the evidence that they had the hard drive already. That's not how they got the hard drive on CP. The only allegation is that they essentially expedited the process because they got the password, NIC1987, which, by the way, is the child that you had your direction from. That was what unlocked that drive. And even in the appellant's brief, I believe it's on page 51, he acknowledges, he seems to acknowledge, that OSI would have inevitably been able to open up that hard drive. So even assuming everything that's true, even if you're not going to look at inevitable discovery or attenuation of taint under this analysis, well, you really need to know really whatsoever. I see that my time is almost through. May I briefly conclude, Your Honor?
Okay.
Thank you. So Jones revived a trespass doctrine that the Supreme Court had expressly and repeatedly repudiated, and it found was not the operative test for determining whether there was a search. In assessing whether exclusion is appropriate in this case, this court must balance the deterrent effect versus the cost, and the cost in this case is as high as it gets. This appellant engaged in the serial exploitation and sexual abuse of children, and he could walk free for those crimes. This is the very heavy cost of the exclusionary rule. Now, is the cost worth it in this case? Absolutely not. There is no deterrent effect by punishing the agents for following in good faith a substantial body of binding and persuasive case law. Moreover, the inevitable discovery and attenuation of taint doctrines apply in this case, and the military judge did not abuse his discretion in finding number one. And we would invite this court to publish its decision with respect to the application of the exclusionary rule, because that has not addressed it, and no other service court has addressed it, adopting the test of USPA. And equally as important, Captain C.H. never revealed any client confidences, nor did he pierce the attorney-client privilege, and thus he did not violate any obligation to his client. Appellant therefore received effective assistance in counsel, and he is entitled to zero overview. Thank you.
The court commission, I'd like to very briefly address the last issue addressed in my hope to my opposing counsel and then answer any questions the court has that relate to the court of the other matters. Okay, proceed. Judge, I would like to very briefly address, I would like this court to think about the following scenario. An accused and his spouse come into an attorney's office, and the accused is charged with a drug charge. And the accused says, look, Mr. Attorney, the drugs are at so-and-so's house. Would the client present? If the police, upon seeing the attorney, the client and his wife, leave the attorney's office, pull them over and investigate and interview the wife, and the wife says, yes, he just told me the drugs are at so-and-so's house, that is a very markedly different matter than the attorney picking up the telephone and calling trial counsel and saying, you just told me that the presence of the client, since the wife is there, it's not regular. The drugs are at so and so. That is much more closely akin to what we have in the innocent case. I would also like to address one matter made by my very good friend, Captain Alford, but I want to take the task of something. That's why the fact that he's a good friend of mine. He said, you should not trust the appellant. I am speaking for the appellant. I am assuming that Captain Alford made my client, but I did not know that for granted. And then finally, Captain Alford says that the counsel in this case did exactly what he should do. No, he did exactly what he should not do. One, he should not have given a phone to his client to his client and then be prison in the first place. Two, he should not have called the trial counsel and provided them the information about Mr. Kennedy that they did not have. Your Honor, does the court wish to address the 404D matter, or does the court have preference one way or the other?
I did want to ask you, cutting off that word again, but let me ask you before we will be in the same question. File of, can this court, at this stage, consider whether it was misconduct?
No. And I would say for two reasons. One is there was a lack of notice. Therefore, the appellant would have to potentially defend against this on a very different way. But even if this court disagrees, the fact is that 414 still requires an act, a crime. We do not have, either under the 404D language, an act, a crime, or a or under 414, a criminal offense. What we have, not to be true for I think I'm plenty proof in my brief, but what we have is an involuntary physiological act, not a response. There is simply nothing on the record that establishes that the tumescence that took place in this case was in any way related to what occurred. And secondly, as it relates to Ms. Creeper's testimony, I don't know which one the student court was asking about, but as it relates to Ms. Creeper's testimony, the allegation that there was a non-consummated marriage for 3 years could be every bit as much an indication of two people who simply don't get along as it is for whatever nefarious matter of reason the government wants to point out. I'd also like to point out the I'm sorry, did we get rid of this asking something?
On the forum for being a chair, you cite the forum selection is one of two
absolutely
reasons why you assert prejudice resulted.
Absolutely.
Is it automatically prejudicial when an accused changes his form of choice based on an evidentiary ruling? And if not, then what makes this case different?
Well, I think this is the main thing that makes this case different. I've never seen a counsel, I give kudos for that, just saying on the record, this is why we did this. And I think the counsel did a very good job of establishing why it is that they went with a judge loan selection as opposed to a panel. So is it per se prejudicial? No. Is it in this case? Absolutely. And Judge, I think that you know the one thing that the government counsel missed is that there is a very good reason why we do pleas and motions before we do form selection. Right? We do motions before we do form selection. And that is because very frequently those of us that are actively trying cases make our form selection based. we say, well, based on that, I'm going to select this particular type of form. But in a case like this, where the Appellant's counsel did a very good job of putting on the record, I think the question breaks and nerves from the back of the form selection.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? And I realize we've got your only grounds for sort of printing this, but what's different about this case? If counsel routinely make form choices based on evidentiary rulings, and you're saying it's not per se prejudicial for them to do so, what was it about the evidentiary ruling in this case, or what was it about the nature of this case that made the foreign choice prejudicial?
And I think this court can very much look at its experience in trying to deal with the trial, when I did not try, but we certainly all try in cases and see plenty of cases on appeal. A panel would take evidence that there's a substantial risk that a panel would take evidence like this and draw a very different conclusion than a military judge would, and would punish you simply for being a deviant, which is what the government attempted to paint them as. In other words,
doesn't that indicate then that the foreign choice actually diminished any prejudice that resulted from the admission of this evidence? That by the opponent's own actions at trial, chose a form where he thought that the foreign would be less likely to attribute undue weight to this evidence?
No, Judge, it doesn't. That will tell you why. Because military judges presume to know the law. We presume that the judge in this case knew the law. And that when the judge says, I'm admitting it for this purpose, and I'm giving it this way, we presume that he did that. And so now take a step back and say, well, because it was the judge on the trial, but the prejudice is less, and I believe we gave an incorrect analysis. I don't believe it's a question of one is better than the other. I think it's just a trial strategy that the defense counsel made at that time. But there are every bit as many reasons to say that a choice of a judge alone, what was at this point almost like a Hail Mary, because our case has been gutted, because it's absolutely admissible evidence, and at least a judge is going to be able to say, okay, I'm going to give the weight accorded by the law, but I'm not going to go crazy with it. And are there any questions? Any further questions with regards to the 404 we have, judges?
No.
I'm sorry, Judge.
No.
Okay. Subject to any further questions from members of the court, and that will conclude the appellant's presentation.
Thank you very much. Counsel, thank you for your arguments as well as your briefs. We will render a decision in due course.